This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by TradeStation. Find out how to get 90 days of free trading and free access.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
China data in focus. We got PMI and Tesla. This week ahead, and lots of earnings, 200-plus companies reporting. And also, we have the wealth effect, kind of fading. All this and much more on this episode, number 360 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, how are you? Andrew Horowitz here, and it is episode number 360. Happy Easter to you. And we are going to be talking about a lot of topics today because there's a lot of news out there, including what's happening in China, the situation in Russia, as well as earnings that are going to be coming up throughout the week. As a matter of fact, we have over 200-plus companies that are going to be reporting, about 19 to 20 from the S&P. We'll talk about that in a little bit, though. We had an interesting week last week in terms of the markets in a holiday-shortened week. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. So, where are we? Well, we're kind of back to the V-bottom bounce that we have seen so regularly over the last year or so, where markets seem to sell off with a vengeance over a period of time. And then all of a sudden, you turn around, there's a reversal day where we see a low made, and then all of a sudden a turnaround into a little bit higher or even higher than the previous day after the sell-off has been going, and then it's off to the races. It's like nothing happened. We get close to, again, a near all-time high, but a little bit away from it right now. We did see the Dow Jones Industrial Average a little bit weak last week. S&P pretty much flat, NASDAQ as well. Nothing major happened if you kind of culminate all of the movement throughout the week last week. But yet there were some interesting plays inside of the markets in terms of individual stocks, as well as the dollar, which has been heating up and gaining some strength. Probably the most interesting thing that we have seen is that there has been a tremendous amount of movement in the bonds. If you look at TLT, the ETF that tracks the 20-plus year treasury, or the TBT, which is the inverse two times of that, you'll see that there has been some significant movement. With better than expected economic data, you've been seeing that the bonds have been selling off. And in fact, usually the relationship would be such that you would see that when bonds were being bought, that stocks would go down. This is historically what has happened and historically what you would see in a quote-unquote normal situation. The rotation from stocks to bonds to stocks, possibly into alternative assets as well. Safe places to invest, as in the safe places, currencies, that would be Japan possibly, the U.S. dollar, and also, of course, you have commodities, gold, silver being those safe haven types of assets. Lately, you've seen that there has been a very, very strong movement in food commodities. We're seeing that coffee itself is up somewhere about 80% this year. And overall, if you track DBA, which is the ETF that tracks four different foods, you'll see that's up about 16% this year alone. That's causing some problems for a few stocks, which we're going to get to as well. And what that also shows us that we're seeing a little bit of inflation start to peek through. In fact, you saw that inflation numbers, the CPI, came in twice expectations after the PPI, the producer price index, came in a little bit higher as well the previous week. So you're seeing that finished goods, as well as the wholesale side, and also the CPI, which is the goods that we buy, you and I buy, are also starting to rise in price. Not only are we seeing the core CPI move up, but all the components underlying much of the inflationary data. Now, this is something that you actually want to see. You don't want to see runaway inflation, but you want to see that inflation is picking up, because the worst thing that can happen is that you have a deflationary environment, which is what's happening in Europe, and they're trying to fight that. Now, one of the things you don't want to see, of course, is the extinction of quantitative easing and the increase of rates. That's not really good for markets. The easy money policy that the Fed has put out has been very good. But at the same time, you do want to see the economy starting to stand on its own. And inflationary pressures are something that is part and parcel of a growing economy. So I would take the fact that we are seeing some inflationary pressures start to come through as a good sign for the economy. Now, whether or not that's actually going to be good for stocks is yet to be seen. We're seeing reports out that companies have taken on a tremendous amount of debt, more debt than they've seen in a very, very long time after they have restructured and cleaned up their various balance sheets and really taken many of the high-yielding debt that they had that has expired, or they've refinanced in a way that it's a much lower cost. We know that companies are doing this in a way also to boost up their share buyback programs. What they're doing is they're going out and they're lending money, you know, they're issuing bonds, and they're taking that money in, and what are they doing with it? They're issuing more dividends, and they're also doing buybacks. Part of what we have seen over the last 2 years in particular, maybe 2.5 years, is that companies are shrinking their float. There's less shares traded. And when you have a simple supply-demand context of buying stocks, you see that there is more money, or even the same money, chasing fewer shares out there. On top of that, you'll notice that there hasn't been a lot of selling. Really, it's all about a little bit of buying pressure really pops the markets, because a lot of people have come to the understanding that, you know what, even though back in the day when things were really falling off a cliff and stocks were down, you know, the S&P was down 35% or so back in 2007-08, and those bad times that things were getting crazy in 2009, and it reached that low in March of 2009, and everybody was throwing out everything, and stocks were just absolutely plunging. If you held on to it, companies have a way of making it back. You can always, quote-unquote, always, lots of quotes around that, and with italics, bold, underlined, you can find that stocks will do well. Is that really the case? Yes and no. With an easy monetary policy, with liquidity in the system, with the fact that there really is no other game in town, you look at the situation of what to invest in these days, and you know what? You come up with, well, I'm going to invest in bonds or CDs that are maybe 1% or 2%, or I can go out and get stocks. I want to read you some interesting statistics in terms of yield on stocks, and I think maybe this will crystallize this for you. I think it's really important to understand that stocks are actually yielding some pretty good overall returns right now in terms of the dividend yield. As an example, let's take some of the stocks in the S&P 500, and I'm going to read you some of the names and read you the yield, and then I want you to think about the yield as I talk about them in terms of the excess yield you're getting on these compared to, let's say, a CD, or maybe a bond, municipal or treasury or corporate. Diamond Offshore Drilling, 7.23%. Pretty impressive. Cablevision, 3.72%. Plum Creek Timber, 4%. You have, let's go down the list and find some other ones that are interesting. Philip Morris, 4.52%. These are all the current yield right now on the price that we had as of the close of the market last week. Pretty impressive, right? Kraft Foods, 3.69%. McDonald's, 3.23%. And you just keep on going down. Now, some of the higher yielding ones, for example, AT&T, 5.1%. You have also Petco Holdings, 5%. This is pretty impressive when you really think about that. Windstream Holdings, I'm not talking whether these are good or bad stocks, just showing you what these are in terms of yield, 11.3%. Freeport-McMoRan, 3.79%. Frontier Communications, 6.73%. Even Wynn Resorts at 2.4%. These are very impressive. Intel, 3.3%. So now you're looking at these stocks, you know, whether it's a Pfizer, 3.44%, General Electric at 3.2%, and some of the other ones that are even higher in the 4% range. When you look at like a Kimco Realty at 4%, okay, Chevron, 3.23%, Verizon, 4.4%. This is very impressive. What you're seeing is that yields in terms of dividends in the 3 to 4% range on stocks clearly beat your average fixed income investment. And that should tell you a little bit about why there is this added benefit that people are seeing in buying equities. Now, obviously, here's the problem. The problem is you got a 4% stock, okay? And let's kind of go back to that list and look at what maybe the three-month return is. Or even better, let's look at the year-to-date. Now, Diamond Offshore Drilling at 7.23% is down 13% this year. Noble Corp, which is, has a yield of 4.94, is down 19% this year. Cablevision is down 10% this year. They have a yield of 3.72%. Now, I mentioned some of the other ones, okay? Philip Morris, 4.52% yield, down 4.5% this year. You look at then CenturyLink, on the other hand, is 6.27, up 8% this year. McDonald's basically is a yield of 3%. It's up 3% this year. You look at a variety of these names, and you can see that there are some that held a benefit, but here's the problem. Freeport, which is up, has a yield of 3.79, year-to-date down 12.5%. The problem that you have here is that when it comes to the yield, you have to be very careful because that could be pretty much evaporated if the stock is not valued correctly. So those people that are running for yield right now have to consider, is the stock really valued at the right level? And if it is, okay. But if it's not, well, I could possibly lose that yield in just a couple of months, the yield that I was expecting to get all year. Now, on the other hand, remember something. The yield also does something else for me. The yield gives me a little bit of extra benefit because while I may lose, let's say, 5% on the stock, that 3% yield really nets me out at the end of the year only a negative 2. So I get some backstop. I get some protection. You do that sometimes with options by selling calls, selling puts for that matter, and you get that income in. Well, you have that income as a base, as a floor of what you're going to get this year, assuming they don't decrease the yield on the stock for whatever reason. But considering that we're seeing a lot of dividends actually increase this year and last year, you know, a lot of people looking at that as an opportunity. So what we did was we came up with a screen that has, okay, what is the highest yielding S&P 500 stocks? And here's the list, the top 10. All right, we start with Windstream Holdings yielding 11.34%. First Energy Corp, symbol FE, 8.18%. Diamond Offshore, 7.23%. Freeport Mac Brand, 6.82%. Frontier Communications yielding 6.79%. CME Group, 6.35%. CenturyLink, 6.27%. Progressive Corp, 6.23%. Newmont Mining, 5.2%. And HCP, 5.18%. I'll put that list as well as the year-to-date returns as of the most recent date. When we talked about this, actually, it would be last Thursday close. And we'll put that information on the show notes for this particular episode. I think some interesting information there that you can use if you're looking for yield. Again, there's not a recommendation for these, but just something to take a look at. I want to mention at this point, TradeStation. We love TradeStation because TradeStation gives us the access to markets in terms of visualization in the form of charts. And of course, charting is very important. If you follow me for any length of time, you know that we subscribe to the Quanta Funda Tecna process, where quantitative analysis is used to find stocks and to look for opportunities. We then break it down into the fundamentals and look at what's going on under the hood. But finally, when to buy, when to sell, the pricing of it, direction, trend is all about the charts. And that's what TradeStation is all about and what they do the best in the industry. And TradeStation, the package that you get with them includes not only screeners that you could do for use for the quantitative analysis part, but also you could do the underlying work when it comes to charting better than anywhere. There is not only charts that you can put on multiple desktops. I have personally 4 very large monitors that we spread it all the way across, and you have various desktops and tabs you can click back and forth, but alerts for watch lists in the form of radar screens, and more importantly, you can have any of the indicators that you want on either the chart or the radar screen. They also have the trading app store, which you can get all sorts of professional applications, try them for a while, buy them if you want. Some of them are free, some of them are cost items. You can get the stuff from Trigger Charts that we put out. We're about to put out an economic chart package, which will be free, by the way. And we're also putting out a brand new relative strength package and training app style that you can find on that will tell you exactly how the various sub components of the S&P are doing compared to the S&P. You look at the utilities, you look at technology. How is it performing? Where's the rotation happening? So you can get all of this. And the better part of this is 90 days of free trading, as well as 90 days of free access to the full gamut of what TradeStation platform has to offer. Just go to the website, our website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you can just click on that and find out more about it. There's a little image and a little clickable item right in the middle of the show notes for this episode, or on the left side of the main page of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll also mention that every other Tuesday, we present a update on stocks and ETFs at 11 a.m. And you can find out more. Just look up TradeStation blogs, TradeStation update, ETF stocks, Andrew Horowitz, and you can register for free. And it is a webcast where we present and show you what's going on our screens and our monitors right to your desktop. It's also recorded. You can find those as well. You find the links on the Disciplined Investor or over at TradeStation. But the complete package right there, and I really encourage you to check it out. TradeStation, the best in the industry. I want to talk about a couple of the key economic numbers that occurred last week, a couple that I focus on. And importantly, we also saw that there was some important reports on earnings. Now, next week, we'll get to it in a minute, but next week is chock full of earnings. But 30 or so key numbers are going to be released from companies reporting, about 19 or so from the S&P 500. We saw a few of the big names already report last week. And I wanted to kind of go through what it is that we should be expecting, what is going to be the underpinnings for the market over the next week after we talk about what happened last. Now, we did see that it was a holiday-shortened week, of course, and the markets had a bit of a hard time on Thursday, it was, because we did see some, I would say, some lousy numbers from IBM. Google actually missed also. They had an earnings miss that was interesting. One of the big things that was reported that their cost per clicks were down about 9%. Now, their overall clicks were, in fact, up, but we're starting to see that maybe some of the alternatives in the space, like maybe some of social media, is starting to maybe tick away at some of their luster. And Google was down about 3% after that news. IBM was also, I would say, just ho-hum. While the company came in and it met, the fact of the matter is that much of it is being done by engineering. A lot that we've talked about in the past, because IBM is all about stock buybacks and really shrinking the float that's outstanding to do their best to increase the overall earnings by having less shares outstanding. I've said on the DH Unplugged show, what is this company? I don't even know what IBM is anymore. They've shed so many parts of their business. They're all about retooling with their balance sheet and their cash flow statements in order to make earnings look better. And even though they did come out with a comment that they are still satisfied with their overall annual results and they'll make their targets, I think that is starting to get a little bit of question when it comes to what is IBM really doing. If they're just going to be plodding along and showing reducing revenues but earnings stay up, is this nothing more than simply the whole effect from shrinking their float? And I think there's a lot of people are starting to recognize that finally. And we just also saw that SanDisk came out with earnings, and I was kind of surprised because you would wonder, as we talked about last week, what is this whole sector all about these days with all the cloud computing that's out there? You know, do we really need to have much of the products that SanDisk provide? Well, I guess the answer is yes. Still, there is a good amount of earnings and revenue growth that this company is having. As a matter of fact, the stock was up close to, I think, 9%, 8 or 9% on the trading day after they came out with their earnings. Very impressive that they're able to continue to do what they do and in a growth manner, growing the company even though they have obstacles ahead of them. That's the kind of thing that you want to see with a company in a situation where they are having a lot of competition and the potential for new technologies to take away some of the earnings that they have. Now, I think the big issue that we talked about at length last week was what's going to happen with Chipotle. So Chipotle comes out with the earnings before the market opens on Thursday, and they actually missed by a pretty significant margin on their EPS, their earnings number, but they come in a little bit better on their revenue. Now, the whole idea of what we talked about, I don't know if you took advantage of this, but the idea that we talked about on the downside for this company was that they're continually seeing pressure on their margins due to the fact that they have an increase and a substantial increase in basically all the components of what goes into making their product. Now, we're not taking anything away from this company, not talking about the management being a problem, but we're really talking about this competition in the space these days, and that's expanding. And the fact is that we're also seeing that there is a significant amount of margin erosion that potentially could be going on. Now, when we look at this and we see actually what the report was, you did notice that, yes, we did see that operating margin was slowing down. And we charted this out and we looked at this over the last several years, and we saw that from 2006, there was a couple of hiccups here and there all the way through about 2012, where they reached their peak operating margin. And then there's been a lot of choppiness in there. But recently what we're seeing is that operating margin is starting to erode again. Now, in 2014, to be fair, the beginning period of 2014, there was of their reporting period, that is, there was a real drop-off into the 15% range of their operating margin, and it did pop up into the 17. One of the big reasons was that they did increase their menu pricing. And remember, we talked about that last week, in that if they were to increase their menu pricing immediately, this would actually be good for this company. The stock was up about 6% on the report, which was pretty surprising. I guess it was a short squeeze, and there was better than expected revenue, thinking, hey, you know what? If there is going to be a drop in the overall food cost in the future, well, there's more people buying, the menu prices are working on the increased side, and that's good. But at the same time, you have to wait a little while. What do we wait for? Well, we wait for the conference call. So we listened to the conference call in the mid-morning, and sure enough, there was a lot of discussion about the extra costs that are going into making their product. Cost of avocados, cost of beef, cost of chicken. All these things have been a serious impact on their bottom line. And that can be seen through their EPS. That can be seen through their operating margin. Now, what happened was, as the discussion progressed and there was really nothing about an immediate menu price increase. As a matter of fact, the only discussion was that they have the trust of the people, they have the quality of product, and therefore the potential to increase their menu pricing in the future. And if so, it's only going to be single digit increases. And that started to weigh on the stock. During the conference call, the stock came in a bit, maybe up 4%, 3%. And as the questions were being asked about this particular topic, and there really was no significant discussion that would show that they were in favor of immediate or near-term increase in menu prices. As a matter of fact, they pushed it out a few quarters. The fact is that the stock started to really get into trouble. It cracked the zero line and ended the day down about 6%, about a 12% top-to-bottom turn for Chipotle. And it's right now in an area that has limited support. Now, we'll see what happens here in the next week or so, but exactly what we talked about, if you looked at the trend and you looked at the components and you looked at the fundamentals of the stock, you would have picked this up. You could not really have picked this up in the charts because, you know, we do see a lot of volatility on earnings. And in fact, the chart was really not telling us that much. The only thing it did tell us is if it broke above this number or broke below that number, there was potentially a problem. And it did almost both of those basically during the day. During the day Thursday, it really kind of broke both sides. So if you were a buyer and you were looking at technicals only, you would say, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's something behind the scenes that I should be doing. And that's where the bidding came in. And that's why through about noon on Thursday, the stock actually did well. But actually the turnaround happened after the conference call when the fundamentals really took over. And then reality set in that there is some problems due to competition, due to margins, due to the high cost of their inputs, and the stock moved down. You know, I told you, and I mentioned that we are short for our clients at the TDI Managed Growth Strategy of CMG a couple days prior. Actually, don't usually play the earnings that way, but this was something that we felt very strongly about. And on top of that, we actually had that as a pick for last week's DH Unplugged. So that's what happened last week. In terms of economics, there was a couple of things. There was a bit of a mixed bag. We saw that the initial claims numbers came in a little bit better again, just hovering over the 300,000 mark, which is still pretty low considering where we've been. And on top of that, we saw the Philly Fed Manufacturing Index pick up a bit. That was good. The overlying, or under, I should say the underlying issue that's still disturbing markets is what's going on in the Ukraine and Russian whole debacle. The unrest and the potential sanctions that were going to be placed upon Russia if they continue with their escalation, or at least at the current level of their current actions from the U.S. and the EU, we're going to weigh on them. You know, it's interesting. This is a situation where we realize that we don't have much interaction. We really don't rely on that region for very much of our economics and the overall economy in the U.S., but why is this weighing on us so much? I think it's just the fact that the indecisiveness and the question about, well, where is this going to play out and is this going to escalate into something further really has a lot of people on edge. And you add that to the fact that earnings are coming in a bit mixed in some areas and there has been a very, very clear distribution going on and selling off in a major way by institutions, bringing down their equity exposure, even though we hear them always talk about they're very constructive. But we're seeing, it's very apparent. Look at the volume, look at the numbers, look at the direction. Markets are, yes, very much able to shrug off a lot of bad news, but when we get those few days and we see that things really are not playing out the way that there is expected to be, whether it's due to Yellen, whether it's due to the international arena, whether it's due to the fact that China's GDP came in lower than it was expected and Japan is also having trouble, but yet we see that the EU, on the other hand, is considering some form of, you know, quantitative easing or bond buying or stimulus, well, the markets react very, very strongly. So the tape is really very reliant on external data right now, and much of that is beyond the scope of U.S. economics. That's what's really interesting right now. It's really not the U.S. economics. Because, yeah, we do see that things move, but you know what? Most of that is still shrugged off because we have the Fed as the backstop of everything, it seems. And even though they are depleting their bond buying program ever so slowly, well, the fact is that there is the external factors that are being brought in. And because we are a global economy, a global world economy, that's all playing in very, very strongly. Now, next week we have, starting off on the 21st in the morning, the Chicago Fed, not that important, but on the 21st also at 10 a.m., the leading indicators will be coming out. More importantly, I think we have some housing numbers that we really need to focus on. At 10 o'clock on the 22nd, we have existing home sales expected to be about 4.55 million, a little bit of a drop on an annual basis than we saw last of about 4.6. We're seeing that existing home sales are going to drop about 1%. That's the expectation. And some of this is due to the fact that there has been a tremendous amount of new building for multifamily dwellings across the country, particularly in certain areas. And on top of that, the ever so slight increase of interest rates that they saw over the last couple of months, maybe in mortgages, have been making people slow down on their buying. But I think more importantly is the significant increase that we saw in many of the housing prices that is not keeping up with wage growth in many areas are slowing down the overall existing home sales. When we look at new home sales, that could be a bit higher because we did see that there was a bit of a layoff over the last couple of months due to the weather, a little bit of a pop-up last month, better than expected, but still down about 3%. So month over month, we're expecting about a 2% increase. Now, durable good orders will be out on the 24th at 8:30 in the morning. Watch for this. Expectations of about a 2% increase. You know, this has been a very wild and very wide-ranging number that we've seen. So the durable goods ex-transportations was only about 0.2%. Expectations are for a 0.6% increase. And we're also looking to see that the capital goods orders on a non-defense ex-air, so the core, is going to be up 1%, and that would be really good because last month it was down 1.3%. Initial jobless claims are looking about 315. And then we have the University of Michigan on Friday the 25th at about 10 a.m., 9:55 to be exact. 83 is the final number expected. 82.6 was the preliminary, the second number. And that's going to be important because obviously we know that consumer confidence really drives the entire market. Now, depending on how some of the recent interest rates and some of the global situation was really received, and on top of that, the recent stock markets, because the stock market has a lot to do with consumer confidence. How all that's received will depend on the final number here. I don't expect a significant change. Almost every time we've seen the University of Michigan come out, they've come out with their first, second, and then the final numbers. It's been creeping higher each and every time, which is very interesting. I don't know what that's all about in terms of their calculation and how they're going about that and why the final number is better. But we do see that as a kind of a constant situation has been occurring recently. I really want to look at the preliminary number that's coming out next period as the one that we're going to see moving forward, because that's the one that's really going to play out for the next period moving ahead. That leads us right into a discussion of an interesting article that was out at the end of last week, and it was about the wealth effect. The title was Wealth Effect: Failing to Move Wealthy to Spend, and the commentary starts off with a sentence that says, the wealth effect isn't what it once was for the U.S. economy. While the wealth effect of American households has jumped more than $25 trillion since early 2009 amid rising equity and home prices, the pass-through to consumer spending is lagging the $1 trillion level that would have been anticipated historically, according to Michael Feroli of J.P. Morgan. Now, this means that spending has become exceptionally weak once the wealth account is accounted for. And with wealth gains now moderating, consumer spending could revert to what it already is been, which is a weak trend. He calculates the effect of this and says that since the recession ended in 2009, households have spent 1.7 cents of every extra $1 earned in wealth. That's less than half the 3.8 cent average implied by data between 1952 and 2009. Suggesting the trend for consumer spending gains over the past 3 years has been less than the 1% once the wealth effect is stripped out. One reason for the adjustment may be that those enjoying gains in wealth are already rich, so have less propensity to increase spending incrementally. Withdrawing equity from homes has also been negative for 5 years. The good news is that income expectations are starting to pick up, which should encourage the spending acceleration that greater wealth failed to spark. So I thought that was really interesting and a conversation about what does this mean. Now, we saw that, as I mentioned, that consumer spending was a bit up, and we see that consumer confidence is a bit up, which is all components of really the whole bigger picture of what goes on in an economy. If you have even if spending isn't up, and even if wealth isn't up, and even if you don't have the income levels and wages rising, the fact is if you have consumer confidence, particularly those that are in the, let's say, 6 to 12 month period out, maybe not currently, but in the outward look of consumer confidence is rising, the good news is that what you have is people that will probably spend. So the question is going to be whether or not this whole idea of the increase in housing prices that we've seen and the increase in the stock markets, which are all part, both of them, are part of the wealth effect, is going to be fading a bit, maybe stagnating, maybe not as much gains in either of the two, whether or not that's going to have an effect on spending. And the question is going to be something that we'll have to watch and wait for and see. Already we did see that, of course, because of the various weather issues that we saw in the beginning of this year, and maybe due to the fact that there's some question about the world economics, that spending has moderated. But yet, at the same time, we're going to have to see whether or not companies can do well with that information. In other words, as we again talked about that the prices of goods are going up, are companies going to be able to pass that through if this whole idea of the wealth effect isn't really playing out? And is that going to then revert us back to continuing on the question of whether deflation is going to be an important issue to contend with? And I talk about this because, really, stock markets have been, and investors have been very, very attuned to what the Fed is doing in terms of liquidity. Very much an overriding issue when it comes to markets. Now, if in fact the wealth effect isn't going to play out, and if spending does moderate, and if companies are not able to keep up, therefore not increasing prices and passing it through, therefore CPI may kind of stagnate. That being the case, well, a lot of people will see this as a place where the Fed is going to say, you know what, we need to do what we have to do to keep inflation on the rise, at least up to a point where we see it as a level that is sustainable for an economy to grow, and therefore they will continue to step in. Just thought I'd pass that on to you. There's another article out that talked about hedge funds have been possibly blamed and are the blame for helping spread the financial crisis in 2008. There's a paper out by the Reint Group, R-E-I-N-T, published on April 14. And this is looking at the measurement of how deterioration in financial conditions is spread through various corners of the financial system. And the finding of this gent who put this out says that while the risk of other financial institutions emanated from hedge funds are as small as those commercial or investment banks in calm times, they are greater during periods of market turbulence. A 1 percentage point increase in the risk of hedge funds is estimated to weaken the position of investment banks by 0.09 in normal market conditions. In times of financial distress, though, the same shock increases the impact by 0.71 percentage points. And so, therefore, what's being discussed is a recognition and a growing recognition that hedge funds are systematically important. In other words, what they're saying here is that you need to look at hedge funds, not only banks, but more so many of the components of the financial institutions, each and every component of those, whether it's banks, hedge funds, mutual funds, et cetera, as important. And therefore, who knows if we're going to see some further regulation that is coming down. We're already seeing a lot of headlines that are talking about regulation when it comes to high-frequency trading. As a matter of fact, there was a piece out this weekend talking about how the SEC is going to possibly be looking a little bit further and creating much more transparency requirements by those mutual funds and hedge funds and other players that are pushing trades through a particular, direction in order to possibly benefit. And that is in particularly going to be focused on the high-frequency trading. As we see more and more news of this, we're seeing the opposite happen, where we're seeing many of the companies saying, hey, you know what? We're no longer going to be pushing things through the high-frequency trading. We're going to go through another place. We're going to find another way to do this, that we're not going to have this as an area that's going to be controversial and potentially problematic for us. So I thought that was kind of some interesting things that we need to look at. I think that when you do, in fact, watch what is going on, the discussions that are playing out when it comes to high-frequency trading, that there is an underlying question that we have to address, and that is whether or not regulators really understand all the aspects of what high-frequency trading is all about, and the misinformation that is being presented by many of the news media outlets out there. Because there's a lot more that goes into just simply looking ahead and finding an advance of what order flow is, but there's a lot of other components of this high-frequency trading. So it's not just a look ahead and, you know, possibly this question of whether there's insider trading by doing so and unfair trading practices. There's a lot more that's really underlying this. We'll wait to see if they come up with anything good here. I promised you we would talk about Tesla. Now, Tesla has been under pressure for the better part of a month, 6 weeks, and the stock, after coming out with really good earnings in terms of expectations and the question of whether or not this company was going to be a growth company moving forward, there's been some things that have come out that have been pretty negative in terms of their outlook. Now, one of the things that was exposed and discussed was the idea that Tesla was, in fact, making a tremendous amount of income and revenue from various credits on the fact that they are obviously benefiting from the electric vehicle incentives, and a lot of the excess money that they're earning in terms of revenue that's added on and tacked on to each and every car that's produced is significant, and that's going into their overall earnings and EPS, et cetera. Now, the question is going to be of how much of those are going to be sustainable. Now, we saw that California came out with a notice that, hey, you know what, we're going to be pulling back on this. And some of that, I think, leaked over, and the realization that maybe the next earnings, which are coming out in the beginning of May, may be suspect, may be questionable. Now, also, obviously, we know that if you compare the valuation and looking at metrics compared to other companies in the industry, that Tesla is not putting out, I mean, they're like a small little bitty, player in here. When you look at the other guys, you look at Ford, GM, you look at Volkswagen, you look at all the different players around the world, Tesla really, the number of cars they're producing right now isn't very substantial. That doesn't mean it's not going to be there in the future. But where else are they going to get growth? I think I mentioned to you, I was on a trip recently, and I was talking to some people who are in the business of car restoration. So they know the car industry. They know a bit about what's going on. Yeah, they do a lot of old car restoration. They really focus on that. But when I mentioned the word Tesla, they're from North Dakota. I mentioned Tesla. I said, what do you think of that car? They had no idea what I was talking about. None. I mean, that was shocking. The fact that they didn't even know what Tesla was. And I mentioned it two or three times. I tried to say it in different ways. Maybe somehow I wasn't providing the right accent or something. They had no idea. Even when I explained it, I never saw anything about that, they said. So while many of us are in areas around the world that may have Teslas in their community or in their state, there's a lot of places out there that still don't have it. Now, on one hand, you may say, wow, that's a real problem. And maybe, where are they going to get the sales? On the other hand, you have to say, well, where's the opportunity? Look at that. They're not there yet, but potentially they may be. The fact remains still that charging stations are not as many as we would want them to be if you, in fact, you're going to take this for a long ride. I mean, Tesla has, 300-mile plus battery capability right now, maybe a little bit longer in some situations and depending on driving conditions. But yet, at the same time, if you get to that point where you're getting to the end of your fuel, your electricity that's available, and there's no hope to find a charging station, what do you do? So until that time comes, same thing with natural gas. I mean, there's not a lot of filling stations. Clean Energy Fuels, which is publicly traded, Boone Pickens is a big proponent, a big owner of this and part of that company. You have to wonder, well, would it be so much better if we can get some more of these charging and fueling stations around the country so that we can have these cars really on the road right now with some reliability in terms of distance? But one of the things that over the weekend we saw was a dramatic amount of news about the cars that will be sold in China, not only from Tesla, but from every company, talking about how much they anticipate and how much they expect to sell in China over the next year or so. And there's a lot of upbeat commentary. I got to tell you something. Now, what you need to know about China is that there is, and we do know that there's a terrible pollution problem. So we would think that, wow, an electric car in China makes a lot of sense in terms of the pollution factor, in terms of the driving, in terms of the, what's going on there. Wow, that does make a lot of sense. Now, Tesla is now beginning to start their deliveries of the Model S sedan in China. Elon Musk is, as a matter of fact, in China, and he's making some speeches this week in Beijing, and he's going to be hosting an event, as a matter of fact, on Monday. They opened up a new showroom, about 8,500 square feet, in Beijing in a shopping mall last year, and they're going to be showcasing, and they have been showcasing, their vehicles. Now, there's a lot of opportunity here, but one of the problems is that the Chinese have been a bit reluctant to buy vehicles that are fully dependent on electricity. Now, it's been a struggle. And one of the reasons is that there really isn't a lot of incentive like we have here in terms of tax credits, etc. Now, while there is a good feeling that the opportunity for Tesla is tremendous there, the fact is that they're just starting these deliveries. But the problem is that while there is a significant amount of outlook that there will be a tremendous amount of sales here, The pricing of the car, which is about $71,000 in the U.S. before federal tax credits, et cetera, it's going to be about $118,000 in China. You have to add the shipping charges, value-added taxes, import duties, et cetera, are increasing it. Now, that's interesting. So one of the things that we're going to have to see Elon Musk do is he's going to have to somehow try to convince the government to drop some of that. I don't know if they will. But what I think we have to see is, even though there are a lot of pre-orders there, if the actual pace of sales can continue. Now, they're just in a small area, which is large by any degree when it comes to China and the rest of the world, but they're in a small area. They're only in a, you know, a couple of the big areas, but Beijing being the main one. And the question is going to be, can this work? Now, with Elon Musk in China, I would venture to say that this $200 level or so of Tesla, when you talk about the technicals, is pretty important. And when you get into that area of Tesla, the question is whether or not Tesla can bounce from here. Now, again, the valuation is pretty rich for this stock. The opportunity is very large. But whether or not investors are going to really put their money in, I think we're going to see a move towards the upside as shorts get out of the position into earnings on, I believe, the 7th of May, which is only about a week and a half or 2 weeks away. But the thing is that we're really going to have to see the opportunity for Tesla to move greatly, to see them expand their potential for sales, and to see some of the deliveries being met with future orders as well. So the news flow is going to be very important when it comes to Tesla over the next few weeks. Can they, in fact, win over the Chinese consumer? That is going to be really important. The shares are still up dramatically. I mean, they're still up 32% this year, and they're up, you know, 400% since 2013. And a lot of this is on the back of anticipation of a very good amount of sales in China. Just think about, you know, how much they could possibly sell in China. It's a tremendous opportunity. So there's all sorts of things going on because you have license plate lotteries in Beijing, and you know, you have while you're getting a lot of people that are trying to buy this, again, there's only about 1,400 applicants for 1,600 new energy vehicle plates offered in Beijing. So there's a lot of things that are going on. They also lost their Tesla also lost their general manager of operations last month in China, and so there's some controversy going on there. I tell you, there's going to be volatility. I mean, I like the stock. I think it's an excellent stock. I think the opportunity is great. We need to see them really execute at this point and have no missteps, because I think that when you look at the situation when it comes to the credits that they were getting from California, and the fact that there is some reluctance of consumers in China to buy electric cars and the excess cost there, we hope this is not going to be just simply just the rich getting these as you know, play vehicle. We want to see this really become part of a cultural issue in China, that they're looking to, the government is looking to cut back on the pollution, and at the same time the consumers are buying into this. So watch Tesla closely for all the news that's going to come out over the next several weeks when it comes to China. And of course, on the 7th, I believe it is, watch for the earnings, because it's going to be a pretty volatile time until then. We also have Facebook coming out with earnings this week. Now, Facebook has been faced with a lot of question as to whether they can monetize and properly monetize their mobile. There's a big shift going on from basic web to mobile when it comes to Facebook and other social media. And the question of whether the monetization, which was well received the last earnings, because there was a great switch that was made and the opportunity that they said would be there with mobile did play out very nicely, if that can continue. The growth in mobile is very important. So when we see the Facebook numbers come out, we really need to break down what is going to be the mobile component of this and the growth compared to last. Now, I don't think you're going to see the same kind of growth, because obviously the shift from online to mobile recently is what really made a dramatic move, because there wasn't much in terms of comparables that was being presented. But moving ahead, we need to see that the growth of not only core advertising, but also mobile, is going to be significantly higher. I mentioned that Priceline had a great comment last week where they talked about how they have unlimited funds available, really, for advertising on Facebook and Twitter, and they put a lot of money into Google as well. Now, Google, they see a lot of results, and from the mouth of Priceline, they said they just don't see a lot of return from Facebook and Twitter. Now, whether that's going to be a short-term situation, you remember back in the day, General Motors took out their advertising because they didn't see anything beneficial at all from Facebook. So I think a lot of the advertisers right now are still in the show-me state, in the stage where they're looking to see, okay, we will spend, we think there's a great opportunity, but is there? So we need to see that the advertising is met with results, which will then bring on further advertising, which will then be beneficial to Facebook. I'm still kind of cold on Twitter. I know they had a nice little run there, and I know it's a short-term bounce that's going on right now. I think longer-term Twitter, though, unless something substantial changes in their overall model, it's not a Facebook. It isn't the same kind of situation where you can see just a tremendous amount of information exchanged on each and every individual and then advertising very much laser-like focused on their interests. One of the main reasons is, if you think about it, if you have a Twitter account, you don't have to give Twitter a lot of information. If you're not giving a lot of information about your likes, about what you do, about where you go, yeah, there's some check-ins, there's some geotagging going on, there's some pictures, etc. But, you know, the truth is that if you think about it, it's just conversation-based. So while you are conversation-based and you're talking about a particular topic and they can target that topic possibly with an ad and match it, it may be a very fleeting conversation. It may be just what's in the news at that given moment. It may be just what's on your mind at that time and answering and responding to something else that's going on. It may not be a core desire, a core interest of yours or mine or anybody's that they're really focusing on. That's where the benefit of Facebook comes in. They know everything about you. And therefore, they can target all those things that you want to see or maybe, you know, that you have interest in. And that's where the benefit of advertising with Facebook is, as opposed to maybe Twitter. The difference with Google is Google's everywhere. You know, whether it's Gmail, whether it's Docs, whether it's, I mean, all the other things that they have to offer, there's an opportunity there because it's a core element of what you use every single day. Twitter may be also in a way, but it's very constrained. It's very conversation specific. And sometimes you're not looking for something where you do on Google, you're looking for something. And when you're looking for something and you see the results pop up, well, that's what you're going to go for. It may simply be that you're going to be tweeting and retweeting and you're going to be answering and you're going to be favoriting. But yet the stream of Twitter, by the time you log back on, may be so much lower in the area of where you're advertising, you know, that whole stream and the timing of it, if they don't properly put it right in front of you, you know, again, that could be something that is, you know, going to be looked at as, you know, maybe not as great of an advertising benefit for those companies that are looking for social media advertising. So anyway, take a look at that. Take a look at Facebook. We're going to have also up on the site on thedisciplinedinvestor.com the earnings that are coming out this week, the 200 plus key earnings with the expectation with EPS and also with revenue. How much is changed over the last 4 weeks in terms of analysts bringing down or bringing up estimates, so you can use it as a bit of a cheat sheet. So it'll be in a PDF format that you can actually download very easily, and you can take a look at any of the stocks that you have that may be on this list, when they're coming out, the expected time of release, as well as the information about what the EPS and the revenue expectation is, and then you can match it up accordingly. Now, don't just go. I've told this before. Don't just go for the headline number. Look a little bit deeper at the report that comes out. Look at the extended information. And also, if you can, if it's a company you own and you're interested in, look at the conference call, because there's all sorts of good nuggets of information that come out there. And what I like to do, if possible, is to have the stock chart on the screen as I'm listening to these things and look what's moving the stock. Usually there's a little bit of a delay from what was discussed till the actual movement. but kind of see if there's a trend forming that if something was really key, and maybe particularly in the Q&A towards the end, if somebody's asking a question, you see the stock selling off or moving higher, if that's something that was very much important in terms of the outlook for the company itself and for the earnings moving forward. Well, with that, we're going to end it today. And we are going to, again, wish you a happy Easter, a happy holiday, back to a full week next week. Hopefully, volumes will pick up a little bit, even though we saw that the options expiration was on Thursday. Volumes still were not very impressive. As a matter of fact, on the S&P, according to our tally, we saw that the volume on Thursday, which is usually much higher on an option expiration day, was kind of lower than the 10-day average, a bit lower. Same thing on the Dow, same thing on the NASDAQ, not really anything substantial. And it was lower than the previous day. As a matter of fact, it was a pretty low volume day, lack of conviction. I don't think there was a lot of desire to be looking at a major positioning in anything ahead of these earnings that are coming out. And on top of that, the question of what's going on in Russia, even though they have some kind of potential Geneva pact that is going to help with the de-escalation. If you're interested in any of the things that we do, check it out over at TriggerCharts.com, Trigger Point Research, where you get a 14-day free trial. Or on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, you'll see that we have the Aero strategy that we manage for you, as well as the TDI managed growth strategy. And there's a video there. You can check it out. You can also get the results of the Aero all the way back to about 15 years ago. You can see how it performed, what it's doing. And if you have any questions, of course, write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks a lot for joining me. Tell your friends. Tell everybody. Tweet it if you have to. And you can follow me at Twitter at the username of Andrew Horowitz. One word, at Andrew Horowitz. That is our Twitter handle. Make sure to follow us there. We put out all sorts of things, and you'll be the first to receive the notification of when a podcast is actually up and any news that comes up, as well as any of our various writings, etc. Thanks for joining me. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.